But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
tearing
landed.
Down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to The Advice Show. I'm Zach, a reporter at Citywire, and I'm joined today by Ranila Ravi Burslem, Intermediary Distribution Director for Scottish Widows and Embark, to talk about all things platforms, the trend of white labelling, what this means for advisors, and what's next for the industry. Ranila, thank you so much for joining me. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And thank you for having me on the show.
No worries at all. Getting straight into it, could you please talk me through, you know, the trend of white labelling, where it's sort of gone in the last couple of years? And from an advisor standpoint, the sort of benefits and downsides of it for any of IFAs considering the route?
A very broad question. So let me take it in parts. What I'm seeing in terms of trends, the appetite and let's call it the chatter in the market has died down a little bit through sort of last year, this year, you're not hearing as much. And also, if you look at some of the reports, whether it's Landcat or Next Wealth or any one of those research reports that come out, the appetite for white labeling within the advice market seems to be cooling a little bit. Certainly at certain sizes, I'd probably say the medium end of it. And that doesn't mean that people aren't interested anymore. I just think that they've got other things that they are really busy trying to grapple with, whether it's consumer duty or, you know, fees and charges and reviews, etc. So there's a lot of regulatory pressure which has taken advisor minds off of some of the more strategic questions around white labeling.
And I'm interested, you know, on this sort of the amount of firms that launched white label platforms in the last couple of years. You know, we've seen loads of it ever since, you know, a couple of years ago, Adamas, Hubwise, you name it. But you're right, the appetite has died down. You mentioned regulatory pressure there. I just want to get your thoughts on why you think, you know, there is less chatter in the marketplace and why we are seeing less activity.
So I think there are different segments of the white label market, firstly, I'd say. The advice market absolutely is one segment. But if I think about Embark and the services, white labeling services we provide to a range of clients, they straddle the spectrum of fintechs through to traditional banks, as well as advice firms. And our white labeling offer straddles both advised offerings, so what we offer for LV, for example, through to D2C offerings for the likes of Nutmeg or Wealthify being good examples of that. So we've got a broad church. And when you look at appetite for white labeling, and certainly other providers who operate in the space, we are the only white label offer for, you know, within the kind of D2C market, unless you're going direct to a F&Z or a, you know, one of the other players at the tech end of the spectrum. When you look at advice firms and the regulatory pressures I was referencing, you know, you take any advice firm, even if they've got scale, so let's look at 10, 15, 20 billion of assets under administration. Most of those firms have grown to that size through consolidation. So they bought a number of other firms. What they end up with is a plethora of platforms that they're operating. They're trying to apply a regulatory framework like Consumer Duty across a number of different providers. So one of the large consolidators we were talking to, for example, had, you know, 16 different platforms that they were operating. So it's not a simple, right, let's take the regulatory framework and just apply it. There will be nuances and flavors that they'll need to think about. And that then drives lots of administrative work for the advice firm that they then need to focus on.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Particularly on your point about, you know, just the number of platforms. I was talking to a Swedish wealth manager the other week, and he was telling me one of the interesting things about the UK market that makes it difficult doing business is because there are so many platforms that everyone uses, which he was not used to coming into it. I'm interested because also, you know, of course, advice firms on their own are under so much pressure nowadays, be that the economic environment, be that regulatory pressure. Is that also affecting a sort of a dull in activity on the white labeling front?
I think the economic pressure, everyone's feeling that, right? Not just advice firms. Consumers are feeling that. Organizations like ours will be feeling that. And if you look at the platform market as a whole, it's been quite a subdued market, right? Year on year, if you look at 2022 to 23, actually last year, the market shrunk slightly. This year, you know, the projections are it'll be low single digit growth. And that's asset growth, right? We're not talking about flows here at all. So when people are facing pressures, whether they are regulatory, economic, uncertainty in the political environment, the client and the services that they are providing for the client comes into even sharper focus, because you are supporting your clients through sort of the deep challenges that they are facing as individuals, and therefore your time and effort needs to go into that. Regulatory one, but economic absolutely in different ways would be the second big factor.
In terms of the current options available for advisors, you know, we hear a lot from them about not considering these kinds of tie-ups because they don't want the responsibility. You know, they prefer to just outsource and have everything on that side. What would you say to those kind of advice businesses?
Just to clarify your question, Zach, do you mean they don't want the manufacturing responsibility? Yeah, absolutely. If I think about the manufacturing entity that we are, and all of the things that we need to consider to ensure we are delivering good outcomes for the client, we are delivering good outcomes for the advisor, we are providing not just a compliant but a market-leading service, there is a lot to take on board and keep on top of, not just from a regulatory perspective, an operational perspective, etc. So the most advice firms that have been distributing for a long time understandably wouldn't want to take the risks by taking additional regulatory permissions to be delivering manufacturing services, as well as on a practical level, the capital requirements that you need to be a manufacturer. Because if I think about, you know, if something goes wrong, because things always go wrong, right? Nobody operates a perfect business. If something goes wrong, you have to have capital to put that client right. And we're not just talking one client, right? You could have multiple clients. So liquidity and the requirements that you have for managing that liquidity, all of that adds not just cost, but risk to an advice business. So when they're thinking about white labeling, I think they need to consider very carefully how much of that risk and cost, operational risk, manufacturing risk from a regulatory perspective, etc., they're willing to take on, versus actually they want control of the customer proposition and experience, but they want to stay in their distributor lane and get some of the margin, but recognize that from a scale, complexity, risk perspective, they are not best placed to be taking on any manufacturing responsibilities.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you. And to the you mentioned as well that the regulatory pressure on platforms as well, and you know that's something that's always changing. How do you think, as an industry, I mean, not just firms that run their own white label platform, but just platforms as an industry are doing with coping with that regulatory pressure? Because you know it does seem an increasing burden.
It is an increasing burden, and it is, but I don't think necessarily the regulatory burden is a bad thing, right? Because I think regulation can force organizations to be innovative and think differently about what they're providing. Because at the end of the day, what the regulator is trying to do is ensure that consumers have a fair, transparent and healthy market that provides, and that is sustainable, right? And that continues to provide good quality services at a fair price. So absolutely the regulatory burden is difficult, but I do think there is a positive to it, which is innovation forces innovation, creates different business models. So I don't always think of regulation as a bad thing.
Yeah, of course. And that also ties into, consumer duties focus on value for money, which is for everyone. I wanted to ask you the same sort of question, but around platform fees, how we're doing, because of course we're seeing a lot of changes in not just advice fees, but platform fees as a response to consumer duty.
You know, platform fees are an interesting question, because you've got an industry that, you know, broadly speaking, there are different types of fee models, but in broad terms, people are charging a percentage of the assets that sit on the platform, right? They can have it in a tiered way, they can have it in a tranched way, they can whatever, but the broad brush is the same. Has there actually genuinely been innovation in how fees are charged and how the model works? Not really. However, the platform market doesn't operate in a silo, right? So the platform market, unless you own your own tech stack, you are outsourcing that service to another technology provider. Their charging models come into play in determining how you then charge. Some platforms outsource their services in terms of ops. So as you're scaling up as an outsource service provider, you would also charge on the basis of scale. So that then determines what platform fees are charged. Investments, right? And whether you've got your own tied model, whether you have a vertical integration and you've got your own advisors. So there are, I don't think the platform market, yes, there are lots of platforms, but I don't think all platforms are the same, because I think some are apples and some are oranges, right? You can't compare how the platforms work. Therefore, the margins, how they're driving margins, will be different. But the one thing is consistent: there is huge downward pressure on fees and charges. And I do think having, a foot in the workplace camp, where workplace pensions, there's been huge downward pressure, you do get to a price point beyond which it is not possible to provide, I think, a good quality service. And what do I mean by that? A service that enables you to have enough money to innovate, right? Because how do you create enough buffer? So what would be a shame is to not have the platform market become so transactional and so commoditized that there is no capacity for innovation.
Do you see, it strikes me what we sometimes hear from platforms is a kind of race to the bottom on pricing, which for those reasons you've just outlined, many would want to avoid. Do you see much of a race to the bottom happening?
Yes, a little bit. So, where there are... and they shall remain nameless, so don't try and push me on asking who they are. There are providers in the market who are really making a play on price. I mean, you don't need me to tell you this, right? You can look at an NNG report or any one of the research reports, and they will say from a price perspective who is a pure price play, who is a value leader, and... et cetera, et cetera. I do think that I think there's a place for different types of propositions, because at the end of the day, the fundamental platform service at its heart is very vanilla, right? Every platform, it has pretty much the same functionality, does pretty much similar things. Then what you're looking at is how do you differentiate in the margins, both in terms of the user experience that you're providing at the front end, as well as the full end-to-end service that you provide, and how easy are you to do business with, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there is opportunity for platforms to not just compete on price, but to compete on value, because every market, not just financial services, you have luxury brands and you have cheapest chips, right? So if you can have a Waitrose and you can have an Aldi, there is no reason that in the platform market you can't have both ends.
Yeah, and innovation is something that we think a lot about with platforms, particularly, some saying that over the last sort of 5-10 years, there's been a lack of innovation.
Really?
I want to get your thoughts on that and why that's the case.
So why has there been very little innovation in the market? I think, I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that. I think the platform market, depends on how you're looking at the innovation lens, right? Because you could argue the innovation is white labeling becoming a thing, right? Actually, enabling advisors to offer their own platform and control more of the value chain in itself is a different way of innovating within the platform market. So, and if you look at some of the newer platform players who come in, they've done some interesting things in terms of functionality, integration, through to, let's call it bells and whistles that they might offer. That is innovation. It might be innovation with a small I rather than a big I, but in my mind, white labeling is an innovation with a big I, right? So I'm not sure I quite agree with that statement. And
no, fair enough, fair enough. And you know, we're sort of coming to the end of the podcast. Lastly, I just wanted to ask you, it's been massive for us lately. We've been following the developments of you know, the SCA telling platforms to stop double dipping at the end of last year, and mm-hmm. some subsequent developments from that. You know, it seems like this has shaken up a few big players in the market, and we wanted to see where this will go and where this will end up. I mean, you know, where do you think this ends? Because obviously, double dipping is a practice that a lot of people shouldn't be involved in. But I wanted to get your thoughts on sort of where this goes from here.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting conundrum, right? Because so much of this has been driven, well, all of it is driven by where interest rates are currently. Yeah. So to be honest, if I could predict where interest rates are going to be in the next 12 months, I'd be a very rich person, I think. And so to be honest, I think a lot of where does it end up and where does the debate go will be entirely dependent on where interest rates end up from a Bank of England perspective. The only other thing I'd say is if we step back from all of the heat of the argument, everybody compares the cash rates that are available on a platform to what should be what people get through an ISA or a cash rate on a fixed term deposit in a bank. They don't compare it to an instant access account. I would love to see how many instant access accounts have brilliant rates, because I think that is the direct comparator. And at a fundamental level, investment platforms are meant to be investment platforms. They are not meant to hold cash. That is not their purpose at all. So what they also need to balance is at any point a client, an advisor can say, you're holding this, I need to now that money to invest. So liquidity then and managing that cash carefully becomes really important. So those are those kind of three things I'd say.
Thank you. Do you think as interest rates settle that we need to hear a lot less about this issue?
I think so, personally. That's my view, because that's what's got people really exercised about it.
Regardless, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, pleasure. Thanks for having me, Zach.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to The Advice Show with myself, Zachariah Sharif, reporter at Citywire. For more, any questions, please feel free to tweet us at New Model Advisor or contact us at nmateam@citywire.co.uk. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Apollo 11 has
tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth: cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.